This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome once again, everybody, to Blockbuster Mentality. I'm your host, Ben. Before we get started, make sure you're subscribed to us on iTunes, Spotify, or iHeartRadio, whatever you listen to. Subscribe to us. Leave us a review, a rating. It helps us out a lot. We've been climbing those charts. Our last episode with Q from Impractical Jokers is a huge hit, so we thank you all for that. Got another episode right here coming up. At the time of this recording, we got football coming up, football is here. We got football tonight at the time of this intro recording, I should say. Football's back. I know this is a movie show, but you know how I like talking sports at the beginning. My Lions didn't fare too well in week one, but the Buccaneers did, so that is good. I'm in Tampa, so obviously I'm going to root for the team that I live at. I live at that team. I live in the town the team is in. Last couple days at the time of recording this intro, sad news that Norm MacDonald passed. After a long battle with cancer, he kept it secret from friends, family, and everything. And that one hit hard. And he was one of the best out there. Very underappreciated. I don't think people appreciated it enough. I mean, in the comedy world, obviously, people appreciated it. But, outsiders, I guess you could say, looking in, I don't think he was stood out to them as one of the greats, but man, he is, that's a loss that, we're going to feel for a little while, but on to the fun. Had a great show. This was one of my favorite episodes, not only the topic, not only the guest, but because we set out to talk about one thing and we just talked about just everything. So what we set out to talk about was A New Hope, just the movie A New Hope, Star Wars. But we talked everything Star Wars. We nerded out, and we did it with Star Wars super fan. And he's also a director. He directed the Blair Witch Project from 1999. He is directing lots of TV shows. He did Supernatural, Queen of the South. He's did an episode of American Horror Stories, the anthology series. Eduardo Sanchez is our guest today, and we nerd out on Star Wars. If you are watching the video version of this podcast, make sure you check out the background, because he could have a museum with his Star Wars collection. It is very impressive. We were gonna talk about A New Hope, and we reference it in the episode a little bit, but we just talked about Star Wars as a whole, talked about the prequel trilogy, the sequel trilogy, his thoughts on that, and obviously the original trilogy, and talked a lot of Blair Witch Project at the beginning, because we were very curious how that unfolded. It's over 20 years ago now, and a huge shout out and thank you to Dan Franco for hooking us up with Ed for this episode, and we talk about how they met, how they know each other too. So that was fun to learn. Me and Dave talk with Eduardo Sanchez about Star Wars. So here's our conversation. How do you know our buddy Dan Franco? He's been a frequent guest on our show. How do you know Dan?
Dan has been, an actor, in this area for a while, and we've worked on a few things together. We kind of have the same circle of, acting and filmmaker friends. So, you know, we're just kind of friends, but we, you know, we rarely hang out, but it, you know, we never get a chance to hang out, but, you know, he's like pretty much any kind of cool local movie he's in it, you know what I'm saying? So, he did a bit part in something I did years ago, and we just kind of kept in touch and, you know,
Yeah.
that every once in a while.
Great
That's great.
guy.
Well, he listens to every episode, so he will be, we love to flatter him, so he'll be very appreciative
Oh,
for
he's a great guy, man. He's one of the best actors I've ever worked with, honestly. You know, he's
Super talented.
amazing.
Yeah.
So you're in the Maryland area as well then? You stay there?
I live in Frederick, Maryland, which is, you know, I live like half an hour from where we shot most of Blair Witch, so.
Okay. Oh, wow. So that close. And
Yeah,
obviously,
I'm still here, man.
yeah, said so you ain't going nowhere, especially with the success of that flick. I mean, it's what reached the 20th anniversary, what, 2019, right? It was,
So yeah, it's 22 years now. So it's you know, it's crazy, man. I'm you know, I feel blessed to have been a part of it, you know.
How did you become a part of it? I know you've probably talked about it the last 22 years, but I'd like to know
Sure.
how did that project come about?
You know, Dan Myrick and I, you know, we were friends in film school, and we had, you know, we were hanging out and talking over a weekend, and we had just seen a movie called Freddy's Dead. You know, like that Friday, that Nightmare on Elm Street movie, Freddy's Dead, which, you know, was fun and everything, but it wasn't very scary. And we were, you know, this is like early 90s, and we had, you know, just gone through all like the Halloween stuff and the Friday the 13th and, you know, a lot of the gore and all that stuff. And even though a lot of those films were pretty scary, we had gotten to a point, I think, in the early 90s where it was just kind of, you know, there wasn't like great, you know, scary horror stuff coming out. So Dan and I were kind of just like, you know, what did we dig when we were younger? And, you know, we were getting to know each other at that time. So we started talking about these kind of horror movies, and we kind of honed in on a movie called, you know, The Legend of Boggy Creek, and a TV show called In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. And we were like, oh my God, those, you know, kind of pseudo documentary things, you know, would scare the crap out of us when we were little. So we went out and, you know, we rented a couple of episodes of In Search Of on VHS, and we found The Legend of Boggy Creek, you know, on VHS. This was like, you know, early 90s, so DVDs were starting to come in, and we loved it. I mean, you know, the In Search Of and Legend of Boggy Creek definitely dated, you know, and Legend of Boggy Creek is such a low budget movie, you know, but it still works, you know, like there's still kind of, it's still creepy. And In Search Of were the same way, you know, like we were still kind of creeped out by the idea of like a documentary about the supernatural, you know? So we just started talking about like, I wonder if you know, we wonder if we could do that again, you know, we could do that to kind of a, you know, a 90s audience. And we kind of came up with the initial idea of like the film crew, you know, being lost in the woods, and then years later, their film surfaces. But then, you know, Dan and I were, we were in film school. We needed to graduate. We were working on student films, you know. He worked on a feature, I worked on a feature, so it was just like we were kind of busy. And then in you know, so we wrote a little bit of it, but we didn't even name it. We just called it the Woods Movie. And in like mid 90s, like probably 96 or so, we got together again, and we were like, let's do the Woods Movie. And then that's when we really started working on it. We got Greg Hale involved, and Robin Cowie, and Mike Minella, like the other producers, and just kind of started working on it and shot it in 97.
Man, and how was it? You know, I think I've heard some myths and stories. Like, was it, did you try to keep it lighthearted on set? Was it kind of stressful? Was it like, how was the set vibe?
Well, I mean, the set was you know, it's like the weirdest set I've ever been on, because the actors were completely isolated. As you know, we try to keep them as isolated as much as we could. So basically, even when we go visit them, I would tell people, don't talk to the actors, you know. You know, unless they're asking you something specific or whatever, you need to talk to them. Don't communicate with them, like pretend they're not there. And then the rest of the crew, you know, there was like, you know, maybe six or seven of us, you know, a few, not all part full time, but, you know, by 5 or 6, I guess, full-time people. And all we did was just try to keep, you know, up with like what the actors were doing in the woods and try to, you know, we got things going, you know, just basically prepared them for where they were going to land. But the actors were mostly by themselves the entire shoot. And so it was kind of a weird set. I mean, and the tension wasn't about like, you know, trying to get performances or even gear or whatever. It was just basically, you know, how are we going to, we got to stay ahead of the actors. You know, we have to stay, we have to prepare where they're going, you know, before they get there. And that was the biggest stress, you know, because it was 24 hours a day. So basically, as soon as we started shooting, that it was going on, that, you know, the time clock kind of, you know, ticked down, you know, so there was no resting, there was no day off, you know, there was none of that stuff. So it was just kind of 8 days of full on production. You know, so we kind of like, you know, we slept where we could and we, you know, just kind of, you know, broke up the duties and, and, you know, just kind of made it happen. You know, but it was fun. You know, it was stressful, just like any other shoot, because, you know, you don't know what the hell you're doing, you know, it's gonna be good.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was a lot of fun, really great team, you know.
When did you realize you had something with the camera on the actor's face? Because immediately as a viewer, you start feeling like there's something behind you. There's something that there's some, you know, that, and I always hate that feeling when, you know, there's some, even just someone walking behind me, it creeps me out. But that, like, that point of view, when did you realize you had something really good with that?
Well, I mean, we, you know, we, again, we like knew that, that it's, you know, that kind of style of, you know, footage and kind of like style of movie worked, you know, like, it, you know, the, again, In Search of, Legend of Boggy Creek, like those things, you know, were kind of like the predecessors of what we were doing. But, you know, once we started watching the footage and started looking at their performances and, you know, and we watched the footage as much as we could, because like I said, it was a 24 hour a day, you know, shoot. So we had very little time to actually like watch footage. You know, we were always trying to do, you know, getting something else ready. But, you know, we started watching the footage and, you know, the footage was different than what you saw in the movie because, you know, there's a lot of editing, obviously. So
yeah,
we mostly saw a lot of arguing. like they argued all the time. And it wasn't just like, you know, Heather and Josh, it was Heather and Mike. And it was just like, you know, they were, you know, Heather, I think was, you know, we kind of directed her with the directing notes of like, you know, you have to be strong, you know, you're in this male dominated field and, you know, you have to, it's your vision, it's your movie, you know? So you have to kind of take charge. And I think she probably took it a little too far at the beginning and it kind of was kind of pissing off the guys. And so we kind of came back and said, look, you know, this is your movie, but again, you know, this is, the guys are doing this for free. You know, they got you the equipment for free. Like you can't be treating people like that. You know, you have to be cool. So, you know, but still they argued, you know, cause the whole movie was about conflict. And so basically, you know, we knew we had something cool, but then the first moment we kind of, you know, like kind of shocked us as far as like, you know, being, you know, observers to this, because, you know, we were watching the movie just like as the audience would watch it. Like we weren't on set, you know, this wasn't a typical set. So basically the actors would send us the, you know, we would gather the tapes from the actors and we would just watch things that we never even knew happened. You know, like we knew that there was scripted stuff that they were supposed to be doing, but you know, we knew it was going to be improv. So we were just kind of like watching to see what they were doing. And then there was the one scene that really kind of like just knocked the air out of us kind of, you know, in a good way, was when, Mike kicked the map into the creek scene, you know?
Yeah.
Because that was just an accident. You know what I mean? Like we were, you know, we had like a storyline. We were guiding them through the woods and they were really good about hitting all the, you know, all the points that we needed to hit, you know, character points and story points and all that stuff. Like they were just, you know, we would give them little directing notes and they were just really good at interpreting those notes and making them their own and kind of coming up with their own stuff. So Mike, you know, a few days before had kicked the map into the creek just as a joke. But he thought that, you know, they'd be like, oh my God, Mike, get the map. But nobody saw it. You know, nobody saw the map, you know, float down the creek. So he was like, oh, you know, what do I do? So he kind of, you know, when do I tell these guys that I kick the map? So he kind of let things, you know, get, you know, kind of brew, kind of the, you know, the reach the boiling point.
Maybe nobody will notice.
Yeah, maybe nobody will notice. But, you know, Heather and Josh were fighting about it all the time. And the map was continuing to be kind of this, like, you know, friction between them. And, you know, suddenly, you know, he's like, I kicked that map into the creek. So, and the reaction from them and, you know, just that whole scene to us was just like, that's the first time we had seen that, you know, it was like one of the biggest, like, unscripted beats that they yeah. did, you know? So at that point we were kind of like, yeah, we might have something. I mean, if we are like reacting to it, you know, in such a kind of a you know, visceral way, you know, other people are going to check it out. And then obviously once, you know, we saw the, you know, Heather's confession where she put, you know, put the camera, that to us was like, holy crap, we might have something like really important, you know, here, you know, if we don't screw it up. So, you know, there was clues along the way.
Sure. But again,
you know how it is. I mean, when you're doing a low budget movie, there's like no guarantees. And all of us on the movie had already been burned several times by like putting our hopes into, you know, movies that we, you know, projects and then, you know, nothing happening with them. So, you know, we were always kind of like, all right, then let's not get our hopes up. You know, this thing could, you know, could crash and burn, but you know, it seems like we have something cool here. At least, you know, maybe we could sell it to HBO or get a mm-hmm. video deal or something. You know what I mean? So, you know, yeah. And then we started editing and, you know, it started coming together and we were, you know, we started getting more validation from people as they watched it, you know?
And then not only was it, you know, just for the horror genre, it's such a phenomenon, but like, what was your response to, I promise we're going to get to Star Wars, trust me.
But yeah, no problem, man.
What was your response to it being like, almost like this pop culture thing? Like there was like, you know, this being parodied everywhere. And,
I know. No, it was crazy, man. I mean, like yeah. there was, you know, like, you know, when we were getting, you know, becoming filmmakers, you know, we saw, you know, El Mariachi, you know, his story, Robert Rodriguez's story. We're like, oh my God, he made this movie for nothing. And it came out in the theaters and, you know, yep. whatever. And the same thing with Kevin Smith and, you know, and She's Gotta Have It with Spike Lee. And, you know, so, you know, you know, Steven Soderbergh, like there was a lot of like kind of indie filmmaking going on. And so basically, you know, our whole thing was like, oh my God, it'd be great to be like the next Kevin Smith or have the next El Mariachi or Clerks, you know, where those movies like went theatrical, but you know, they didn't make much money. For an indie movie, they made some money, but they didn't yeah. make like real money. So that was kind of our like tip of the, you know, top of the mountain. Like we were like, if we get something like Clerks and we make $3 million at the box office or whatever it was, that we would, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, that was the top that you could do with a $20,000 movie. Like nobody had ever broken into really like really competing with studios, you know?
Yeah, sure. And that's no small thing. I mean,
it was impossible, man. I mean, you know, the marketing muscle and just, you know, the audience expectations of horror movies. Like, you know, we were like that a mass you know, audience is not going to want to see this movie. I mean, like, you know, why the hell are they going to see this, you know, YouTube? It looks like a YouTube video. You know? So we had no expectations. So as, you know, so, you know, we had, you know, not low expectations because, you know, those movies are amazing. And, you know, we would be lucky if we made it to, you know, that to make it to, you know, even when we sold the movie, we considered ourselves lucky. So then, you know, when we sold the movie at, you know, at Sundance and, you know, there was a lot of buzz about it. Like, you know, we had a website, you know, for most of 1998, before we went to Sundance that had, you know, got a lot of attention. And, you know, for the internet at that time, it was a pretty big site, you know, mm-hmm. we didn't market it or anything. It was just kind of word of mouth. And, you know, there was just so much enthusiasm with fans, like even before people saw it. Like I remember one fan, this guy named Jeff Johnson, got on. He lived in LA and he got on one of like the big morning shows and was like, you guys got to check out this website. So, you know, the DJs or whatever went on and like surfed the web for like 10 minutes and talked about Blair Witch. And even this is before the movie came out, you know? And, you know, our website blew up. I think our, you know, the server crashed or whatever, but we got a lot of, and there's a lot of people all over the world that were like really into this movie and like really kind of becoming part of the story. You know what I mean? So we knew we had something that, you know, we were like, all right, this is going to be a, it's going to be, you know, a certain audience, I think, is going to dig this, you know, but we never imagined that it was going to, you know, do like actually compete with like real, you know, studio movies and stuff like that. And then when it, you know, that whole spring and when, before it came out, you know, just every, you know, we got into Cannes and that was a big thing. And then as the movie was, you know, being released, you know, that documentary Curse of the Blair Witch came out a few weeks before the movie, and it was like the highest rated, like, you know, some kind of highest rated in Sci-Fi Channel history or something, you know, whatever original, I don't know what it was, but it broke records. And we were like, holy crap.
Yeah.
And we started getting these indications that the movie was going to be huge. And then, man, afterwards, like just every single time there was like, you know, like Saturday Night Live and, you know, the MTV Movie Awards and Mad Magazine, like when I walked into a store and I saw the Blair Witch on the cover of Mad Magazine and inside and saw that, like, we, you know, Dan and I had been like, you know, immortalized in this, you know, in the actual cartoon, you know, I mean, you know, we grew, you know, Dan and I both grew up on Mad Magazine. So it was like, that was to me, like, was the biggest thing. I was like, holy crap, we're in Mad Magazine, you know? And then, like, we were on the cover of Time magazine, and I remember it looked like, you know, one of those mock-ups you could do at the beach or whatever, you know, you could like get in front of like Sports Illustrated. Like, that's what it looked like. It was right. Just a joke. But it was reality, man.
Yeah.
It was just
something
that was just happening. And luckily it was like five of us, you know, and we, you know, anytime any one of us kind of got a big head, the other ones would kind of knock them down. And so it was good that we were a group.
Yeah.
I think that if I had done Blair Witch by myself, you know, I don't know if I'd be talking to you right now. I think I'd be like a completely different person. I might be dead. Who the hell knows what happened? But like, cause it was a crazy thing that was happening, and it just helped that you were in a, you know, there was like kind of you know, safety in numbers, you know?
Yeah. Keeping you grounded. Yeah,
absolutely.
Would you be living in LA right now?
I mean, I would definitely be living in LA, and I would have probably, like, you know, had a coke problem, and, you know, cause that's the thing, man, is that, like, you know, once you have a hit in Hollywood, there's a lot of ass kissing that goes on, you know, cause everybody's trying. So like a lot of my times in LA, like all of a sudden LA wasn't as fun anymore, because I realized that, you know, there's just a lot of people that are just looking to, you know, to get hired by knowing, right, by being your friend. And now I have a lot of good friends in LA, you know, and I've met a lot of like really cool people, and like people that didn't give a shit about Blair Witch, you know, they just, you know, but at first there was, you know, how I can imagine, like people were recognizing me on the street, man. Like, it was just, you know, it was about as close to like a rock star, you know, lifestyle that I want to live. And, you know, but, and it was kind of scary, you know? So that's why, I mean, like, that's why I live in Maryland. I think part of me like really, got scared that I would, you know, turn into somebody that I didn't really like in LA, you know?
Well, and it's hard to miss you. I see what you're 6'7". Is
I'm
that?
Yeah, I'm huge, man. So anytime I'm in a room or whatever, or I come in, you know, people see me. So, you know, whoever was, you know, I guess in LA, you know, people recognize filmmakers, and people were like, hey, yeah, I love the movie. And, you know, it was kind of cool most of the time, but sometimes it was just like kind of scary, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I remember this one, I was traveling and I was at Dulles Airport, and I was in one of those little people movers, like the little buses. And this guy was like, you're at Sanchez, aren't you? I'm like, yeah. He's like, I hated your movie, man. Like, just kind of like for like 10 minutes, the whole ride, like, just talk shit about my movie. But at the end, he was like, but, you know, it was cool, man. You guys did it. You know, you guys, congratulations. Man. So, you know, it was just like a lot of weird kind of things like
that. What a weirdo.
Yeah, just kind of, you know. So, you know, so that, you know, it kind of gave me a little taste of like, you know, what Tarantino must feel like, or, you know, Scorsese, or any of these like other like kind of, you know, really, you know, really famous filmmakers, you know.
Right.
Because everybody has an opinion, man.
I wanted to ask, I see you have the sideburns, but they aren't quite as glorious as they used to be.
No,
see, return.
I mean, I had like the hockey puck, you know, hockey stick thing for a while. And then I just kind of got to a point where I'm like, you know, I got kids now. I'm not like a rock star. So I have a little bit. I love to kind of make the little kind of, you know, little turn here. But yeah, I used to have them like to hear. Yeah.
So. Those were great.
Yeah, no, they were cool. I mean, you know, it's just like I look at the cover of Time magazine and I'm like, what the hell kind of facial hair are both of us like sporting? Like, what the hell's going on there?
Oh, man. But hey, you know, you gotta take it where you can, you know.
Exactly, man. You gotta let you know, can't sweat too much, you know, sweat it too much. You know?
Exactly. Now, before we get into the movie too, what are you currently working on, or what were you working? I know a couple of months ago we were emailing back and forth. You were on set. What do you got going on?
I just did an American Horror Stories episode, Horror Stories, and had a lot of fun. Very stressful working for Ryan Murphy, you know, because everybody wants to please, you know, he's such a huge, you know, creative producer, and
sure.
So you kind of, you know, you're trying to do your best work. So, like, you know, it's a little stressful to everybody, I think, involved. Everybody wants to do their best. But the episode came out great, and you know, I had a good time, and you know, they invited me back for season two, so you know, hopefully I'll get an episode. But basically, I'm just working in television right now. I have a couple of features that I'm like that really could go. There's some that could go any minute, like basically just waiting for financing or waiting for the final green light. So I'm always developing features. So I have, and mostly in the indie world, you know, like I still love features, but. Mostly been concentrating on television. We had a show at Apple that we're still working on, like a horror TV show. That's kind of our big thing right now for Greg, my partner, and I, is to we've sold a couple of TV shows but haven't gotten green lit yet. So our thing is to have get a show green lit in the next few years, hopefully. Just because we feel like television. I mean, COVID didn't help the theatrical market, but I don't know. It's like even before COVID, it seems like television was kind of the place to go to like take chances and to kind of,
sure,
you know, get deeper into characters and do stuff that, you know, used to be that movies took more chances than television, you know, and now it's the other way around. So it just creatively just feels a lot more satisfying to work in TV right now. I still love features, and I, you know, it's still kind of my first home, and I'd like to, you know, get back into features soon.
Yeah. I mean, it's TV. Yeah. There's so much you can do, and it's just so much story to tell. It's insane. Now, I mean, obviously you're, you know, prominent in the horror world, and but you wouldn't know it by Ed's background. Our audience is mainly audio, but if you are checking out the video, you'd see Ed has I'd say a little bit of a Star Wars paraphernalia. Behind
a little bit.
Oh, Star, man.
Coming from a Star Wars museum, it appears.
Yeah. It's basically like a glory, like a Star Wars museum in my basement. And, you know, it's kind of one of these things, like I always talk about it, like I'm half proud and half ashamed of it, you know, because I love it. I love Star Wars. I love displaying stuff. And but at the same time, I'm like, what kind of hole do I have in my heart that had me go this crap around me? My wife is very patient with me. But now, like, I'm completely running out of room.
Yeah, honey, we're knocking a wall down.
Yeah, as you can see, there's like every section of wall is kind of taken, you know. And I have another, there's another bigger room out there. I'll show you one time, so I'm getting to the point where I don't have, so now I have a rule where, like, if I can't display it right away, I don't buy it.
Yeah.
So,
you got it. You gotta
I have a storage room like in the back, so it's not like I have room to store stuff. Like, I'm already at like 125% capacity, so
man.
I gotta start cutting back. So I am selling some little bits in here and there, and just trying to cut down on the buying, basically. But it's addiction, man.
I like how you say, I can't have the sideburns anymore because I got kids, but I got a room full of toys. So
I know. Switched over from the sideburns to like just buying Star Wars toys. You know, it's
How long does that collection span? How long have you been doing it?
You know, I mean, I've been really after Blair Witch, like I got, a ton of disposable income. And I was in Japan doing the Blair Witch tour, like the press tour. Mm-hmm. And Dan Myrick, my partner, was really into like kind of like tin robots, like old little robot men.
Yeah.
And we went, our guide was like, hey, we have a couple hours. You know, do you guys want to go anywhere? And he was like, yeah, can you take me to like a vintage toy store? So I went with him. And I was the first time I had seen like the original action figure since I was a kid. And he had him like all loose. He had some carded. He had like a land speed. He had all these things. And I was like, and it was a little store. I mean, I don't know if you've been to Japan, but the real estate is very, you know, expensive there. So it was like literally like a little closet of a store. It was smaller than my office. And I looked around and again, I was making a ton of money at that point. I said, how much for all the Star Wars stuff? You know, and the interpreter was, you know, and the guy's eyes were like, what? You know, so I bought like, I think I got like $1,200 worth of Star Wars stuff that day. And and he shipped it to me in the U.S., you know, to the U.S. And then I discovered eBay, and then it was all downhill.
Yeah, they yeah, it is an addiction. Before this podcast, collecting was my money pit. Now this podcast is my money pit. So I had to trade one for the other. But now
what did you collect?
I collected Star Wars figures as well. I collected Marvel figures. Yeah. I mean, it came to a point where I was just like, oh, there's a new action figure coming out. I really want to get that. And I,
it becomes kind of like not about, you know, the thing, but I'm all like about the chase and
right.
It's a little unhealthy sometimes.
Yeah.
I got to back up. I got to back off of this a little bit because I'm getting obsessed, you know. So.
It is a hell of a collection. I'm just looking around and everything looks amazing.
Yes.
To be honest with you. Not to try to, you know, help you along to get some, you know, I'm going to look for something that's missing and then maybe that you can go find that.
That'd be a good thing to do. It's taken over my basement and, you know, so
yeah,
we'll see what happens within the next couple of years. I mean, the dream is to do like a little, you know, museum, like a little nonprofit museum, but you know, I'm a little busy for that right now.
Yeah. Someday though. Hey,
something to look for.
Yeah, exactly.
If anybody out there is interested in, you know, managing a Star Wars museum in Frederick, Maryland, give me a ring.
Dan Franco, maybe. Dan, go for it, man.
Yeah, maybe Dan Franco will come out. You know, and, you know.
Exactly.
I want to know, where did this all start? How did you get to where Star you are with a problem? Let's go to the beginning.
Yeah, when was the first hit? When was the first hit on the net on the vein?
And what gave you that love too? You know, what, like,
you know, man. I mean, I was 8 years old when Star Wars came out, and you know, I remember like I didn't even see it. It took me like a couple of months to watch it because it was so, there was so much, you know, buzz about it. There was, you know, anytime we would try to go to the theater, oh, the whole day sold out. And, you know, and I was 8 years old. It's like, you know, you don't have many options. Basically, if your dad doesn't want to drive you, you're kind of screwed. So, and my dad did love to go to the movies, but he didn't like standing in line and any of that stuff. So we would end up going to see something else. And so fine. But I just love Star Wars from like, you know, the commercials, first of all. Like, it was just the coolest, you know, the trailers were like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And then just the reaction from my friends, like, it was like I was almost like ashamed to have not seen it, and it was like this club that I wanted to be a part of, you know. So I loved Star Wars even before I saw it, and then when I finally saw it, you know, it was just like, you know, like a dream come true, man. Like, it was literally like looking at another world, you know. It was like I'd never seen a film like that, and I think that it, you know, it wasn't like something where I'm like, oh, I'm going to be a filmmaker now, but I think that, you know, and I think a lot of people my age, like I'm in my early 50s, I think a lot of filmmakers my age, you know, were inspired by Star Wars. Like, I think that a lot of filmmakers are filmmakers because of Star Wars, because there had never been anything that, like, you know, like widened your like the possibilities of what a movie could be. You know what I mean? Like the summer before Jaws had happened, and I had seen Jaws, though I don't know why my dad was taking me to Jaws at like 7 years old, but he took me to a bunch of very inappropriate movies. But
Taxi Driver.
Not that bad, but okay. there's some bad stuff because my dad is Cuban. You know, I'm Cuban too, but so he didn't speak English. So basically, if there was ever a movie playing in the theater that had like Spanish subtitles, he would go he would go take me to see it. And it, so it could be anything, man.
Yeah.
So I saw some movies that I'm like, what the hell am I seeing here? You know? Anyway, that's a different podcast, you know?
Yeah.
But once I saw it, it kind of like made me like believe in this magic. Like it really was like to me, like watching Star Wars was a little bit like when Harry Potter discovers that he's like there's this world that he belongs to, like this magic world, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And not that I was an orphan and, you know, I lived under the stairs. Like I had, you know, my parents were good to me. I had a good life, but all of a sudden Star Wars gave me like, you know, a club to be like something to be a part of, like part of my like geekdom, I guess you can call it geekdom now or whatever, but it was like, I was part of this club now. And all my friends were in it, and you know, and it really sparked my interest in how they did it. So I would, you know, I would get Starlog magazine and Fangoria. I started getting Fangoria, and then there was you know, anything that had any kind of article about Star Wars or how they made it or interviews with the actors or whatever, I would, you know, try to find it. And then I started getting interested in, you know, movie books and this and, you know, and this, and, you know, I was a little kid, so it was very limited. And also I was growing up, like I grew up here in Maryland. So,
yeah,
you know, it's not a film mecca. Like I didn't know any filmmakers. I didn't even know anybody who worked in television, you know, other than like maybe the, you know, the newscasters, you know?
Right.
You know, I was as far away from the film business as possible, but at least it gave me this interest and, you know, just kind of gave me this fever to like know anything about how they make movies, you know?
Well, it's kind of like our hero Luke in A New Hope. I mean, it's, you know, when he's looking out at the, you know, that probably my favorite movie scene of all time with it, or movie shot at least, of him just looking out at the sun, looking to see, you know, what else is out there. And then, you know, he finds absolutely, that, you man. Know?
Yeah, just the yearning of like, you know, being stuck in a place. And as a kid, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, at least when I was a kid, I was, you know, there's always this thing of like, when am I going to be an adult? God damn it. When am I going to be an adult? You know? And you're like, shit, you know, I still, so I think that like,
I want a room full of toys.
Yeah.
Well, and I got it.
When can I justify a room full of, you know, toys for, you know, 52 year old man. So it was like, so for me, it was like this, it was very analogous to like, you know, childhood, like being stuck as a kid, but seeing like, oh, there's the future. There's my, you know, the promise, but still being stuck, you know, living with your parents and, you know, for Luke living with his, you know, aunt and uncle and working
right.
on a moisture farm, you know, which can't be too much fun.
No, we're still not really even sure what moisture farming exactly is.
It's just basically farming water, man.
They do that.
Yeah, it's literally I mean, you know, obviously I'm a big Star Wars fan, so I've read a lot of the books and stuff. And there's a book called Obi-Wan, I think, which is about, you know, Obi-Wan and, you know, his adventures and on Tatooine, and explains a lot about water, about the vaporizers and, you know, the systems and all that stuff. Probably too much. So, but we'll probably see that in, hopefully we'll get a lot of vaporizer kind of stuff in the Obi-Wan TV show. You know what I'm saying?
I know, man. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. How excited are you for that? Because, yeah, I mean, that's going to be, I mean, if it's anything like The Mandalorian, I mean, it's going to be amazing. But maybe we'll have a canon explanation on the science behind moisture farming.
Yeah, they're pulling it from the air. What are they doing?
They pull it from the air. That's exactly what they do, man.
There you go.
Yeah, but dude, I mean, for me, like the Star Wars TV shows is like, I mean, obviously I'm a huge fan of them. Like Mandalorian, I think, you know, like my wife, who doesn't really like, even she doesn't even like Marvel movies. Like she watches the Star Wars movies, but doesn't like say, hey, let's watch it again or whatever. She loved Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that, you know, the other shows are also, you know, equally compelling. But my thing professionally, my whole thing is like, I just want to get in there and direct a few episodes. You know what I'm saying? Like that would be to me like,
oh man. Yeah.
True. And I know, you know, I'm friends with Robert Rodriguez, who, you know, did Boba Fett, the Book of Boba Fett. And, so, you know,
he did an episode too, right?
I'm this close, I feel.
Well, yeah. I think that's, if it's going to go to anybody, and this is the problem with, not to go into a Star Trek thing, but this has been the problem with Star Trek over the last couple of years. And some people might say the same thing with Star Wars, is if you're going to give hand over a property like that to somebody to direct that. It needs to be handled by someone who loves that product and loves that IP. If you give it to anybody else, even if their competence aside, it's not going to work as well as someone who has that same love and care for it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I love JJ, but I think that in an interview, he said that he wasn't really a fan of the original Star Trek.
Why are you giving it to him?
I'm like, why would you tell us that? Like, you know, I mean, I'd understand if maybe like none of the stuff that came after the series worked, you know what I mean? Like everything was a flop and they were like, we need to try something completely different. But like the movies worked and, you know, there's plenty of good TV shows, Star Trek TV shows. That was a weird thing, man. I agree with you. Like, I think that you need to kind of, especially something like that, something so big like Star Trek or Star Wars, like you need to find people that have it like in their blood, I feel.
Right. And that's why, you know, it's obvious from Favreau that he loves Star Wars.
Yeah. And Dave Filoni as well. Like, you can tell that those guys are like major Star Wars geeks. And also Robert, right? Like, I texted Robert Rodriguez when he was on Boba Fett, and he's like, dude, I'm like, dude, you must be having some fun. He's like, it's like being a little kid with, you know, the Star Wars toys, but they're all full scale. You know? So I was like, you bastard, man, you got to get me on that. So, well, you know, so hopefully, man, the next few years, especially if they keep, you know, all these shows are successful and they, you know, they have a bunch of them, I hope, fingers crossed, that I can get in there, get my foot in there, you know.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it'd be so great.
And then you can invite us to the set.
Absolutely, man. I was trying to get invited to the Boba Fett set, like kind of laying down hints. I'm like, hey, I'm going to be in LA during the same time. And, you know, but it didn't work.
Not so much. Maybe next time.
I'm at the door.
Yeah, hey, I'm outside. What's going on? Can I get in?
In the neighborhood, literally. I mean, this can just be Star Wars talk. It doesn't even have to be A New Hope. But someone actually seeing it when it came out, when did it become A New Hope to you, or do you still just call it Star Wars?
I mean, I guess, you know, when Empire Strikes Back came out, they kind of, you know, the New Hope came out, they put New Hope like right before they re-released it before Empire, right? I think it was pretty early. They didn't wait till the special editions.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought it was later than that.
I think New Hope, because I think that, you know, he got to a point where it was like, well, we want it to be Star Wars, you know, Empire Strikes Back. But I mean, the original was called Star Wars. I mean, I remember it was Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and then Return of the Jedi, you know? So for me, it was always Star Wars. And for me, it's, you know, like I say A New Hope, whatever, if I'm talking to my kids or, you know, people who came like, you know, prequels and afterwards. Yeah. But anybody, you know, my age or people who know, you know, who lived the original, it's Star Wars. You know, it was just, you know,
right.
Some people like get mad, you know, I'm like, well, A New Hope. He's like, you mean Star Wars? I'm like, All right, cool.
I've always fascinated by the story of how the opening crawl came about. I didn't know this until about a year or two ago. It was actually not the, you know, the style of the crawl, but it was basically came from Brian De Palma. I guess Lucas had showed like him and Scorsese and, you know, Coppola, you know, all the directors back then, a cut of it. And De Palma was like, I don't know what's going on. You need something to like explain what's happening. And it's just interesting to me that, yeah, the De Palma had a hand in that.
It was always cool because, like, you know, the opening crawl was like, that's what they used to do in like the serialized movies in the shows, you know, in the movies back in the day, and they had the serial, like Flash Gordon, all that stuff. They would they had this. So it was crazy that like that stuff inspired him, but he didn't think, hey, maybe we should do an opening crawl, until he, you know, another filmmaker friend of his said, hey, you needed some information here. And you couldn't imagine it without it, like you would be so lost.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you'd be like, what the hell is going on here, you know?
Yeah, because you're thinking, yeah, because it starts, yeah, they're like this guy in black comes in the ship asking for plans to something. Like, yeah, what?
Yeah, no. I mean, it would be like it totally made it. And also, like, you know, I knew about this, but I was reading again recently about like how, you know, like George Lucas had to quit the DGA in order to like have to not have his name at the, you know, in the head credits, like to have just Star Wars and its star. Like you couldn't do that back then. Mm. You had to like have, you gotta have all the credits, man.
Oh, wow. So I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. So just the idea of like doing just that was like, you know, just not allowed. And, you know, and they say he quit the DGA. I'm not sure how, you know, accurate that is, but he had a big, you know, kind of a, you know, a big kind of fight with them because he wanted the beginning to be, you know, just like a, not like a normal movie, which was, you know, that's what was cool about Star Wars, man. I was like, never seen anything like it.
Yeah, it just
opens like that. Yeah.
Just boom, starts with that John Williams score.
And then you know you tilt down, and then the Star Destroyer, you know, that the rubber blockade runner goes, and then the Star Destroyer. Like I remember watching that in the theater and going, you know, it just looks so huge. Like it just went on forever. You know what I mean? Yeah. And and you had never seen anything like that, man. Like the only thing that had kind of come close, which I didn't see till later, was like 2001: A Space Odyssey. Like had some pretty great effects for the late 60s, you know. And obviously, there's, you know, some people involved in that worked on Star Wars, but Star Wars was like, you know, just everything, man. Like, you know, science fiction, you know, as a kid was like everything was all pristine and white, and you know, and Star Trek was like, I wasn't really a big fan of Star Trek. You know, when I was little, I got into it in high school because, you know, it's not really a little kid's show. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, even Star Trek is all, you know, it's all clean. The ship is like modern or, you know, supposedly modern, and there's no trash. You know, Star Wars was like, no, man, everything's used and probably homeless people everywhere. And it looks like, you know, it just looks like a real lived in society. And I think that was like such a genius move. Like it like clicked, you know, like it made it real, even though even though you're looking at like outrageously, you know, ridiculous things, just
Han
aesthetic makes it work, you know.
Right. Han Solo doesn't have this, you know, beautiful ship because he's the cool guy. He has this like
hunk of junk.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it's falling apart, man. And everything, you know, and the, you know, like just the you know, the stormtroopers having, you know, dirty armor and scuffs, and like, you know, that's like you never saw that, you know what I'm saying? It was always very, you know, everything was pristine.
That's why I think I loved Rogue.
And then obviously the special effects were like, how the hell was this done? And then the music, like that was, you know, I mean, I know I was familiar because I was a big soundtrack geek pretty early on. I think right after Star Wars, like I kind of got into John Williams, and then I got into, you know, Jerry Goldsmith and John Barry and, you know, all the famous composers of the time. And I, you know, by basically all I listened to were soundtracks as a kid, you know?
Yeah.
I was a really weird kid, man.
What do you got? I got,
I just got the Tron soundtrack, the LP, Wendy Carlos, man. I'm loving it. You guys got it yet?
You want to rock out to that, bro?
Yeah, it was that kind of thing. But, you know, John Williams, like you look back and you listen to that score and we went a couple of years ago to one of those like, you know, how they play the music live and they play the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Went to see like A New Hope with John, you know, John Williams wasn't conducting, but actually Anthony Daniels introduced it and stuff. It was really cool. But you know, just listening to the music live, you like realize like what a freaking, you know, like that music made the movie, you know, like I think Spielberg and Lucas owe like so much of their careers of like the, you know, of what they did in their careers to John Williams,
because 100%.
Because, you know, obviously they're talented filmmakers. Spielberg is, you know, one of the best ever, but you know, you take the music, that John Williams music out of Jaws or whatever. And it still works, but you could imagine like it, you know, it just didn't click. And the same thing with Star Wars, man, from the very first, you know, dun, dun, you know, like that freaking, you know, and you're like on this ride and, just never had seen anything like that, man. It was just, it was, and or heard anything like that, you know? So it was just so many crazy innovations, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and Star Wars obviously inspired so much more and like was ahead of its time and, you know, inspired other movies. That's why I said, I think in the E.T. episode we did was, I think John Williams might be the most important artist in cinematic history. Like, you know, just because, again, it would have worked, with Star Wars, but without his style of score with that, like,
because you look, you know, like I, you know, like I'm a big sound. I have like 2,500 soundtrack CDs. Like I'm a big soundtrack geek also. And obviously I have pretty much all of John Williams stuff and Jerry Goldsmith, Ennio Morricone, like, you know, all the classics cut, you know, and, you know, and really Jerry Goldsmith and probably John Barry at that era, in that era were like the big, you know, composers. John Williams was coming up. I think Jaws kind of really blew him up, you know? But I, you know, I compare like the stuff that John Barry or, you know, Jerry Goldsmith was doing, you know, like Jerry Goldsmith did the soundtrack to Star Trek, the motion picture. John Barry did the Black Hole, you know, like to me, it's like, I love those composers, but I don't know if they would have been able I don't think they would have been able to create the magic that, you know, that John Williams was able to create, you know what I mean? And it was very much, the music was very much a gateway to all those movies, you know. And I think you're right. I think John Williams, to me, you know, it's like, because I have, you know, you know I have it on random, and sometimes a song comes up and you're like, holy shit, I didn't even know some obscure John Williams movie, and you can hear like the influence and you're like, man, there's just magic there, you know what I mean? And I think you're right. I think there's some, you know, as far as like, you know, the far-reaching effects of his style, I don't think there's anybody been more influential. I think you're right.
So I have to ask, because Blair Witch does not have any a John Williams type score to say the least. Because they're out in the woods, obviously. But as a guy who loves soundtracks and all that, how have you maybe tried to, you know, obviously that's that kind of a movie. I mean, what do you, when the stuff you try to create, you try to implement that
I mean, the problem with my films is that they're mostly small films, you know, like I've never done anything over $5 million. So they're, you know, and I've always been in this, and obviously $5 million is, I'm very happy that I've got even that, you know, honestly. A John Williams score and really in any of my films would kind of overpower the movie. You know what I mean? Like for John Williams, or at least, you know, his big scores. I mean, I know he's done like a lot of versatile stuff. And I think that, I mean, even, I mean, look, if John Williams ever, you know, had the, you know, the, we've gotten to a situation where he could score a smaller film, I think he would figure it out. Like he wouldn't.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying? He's just that kind of, he's a genius. You know what I'm saying? He would come up, like he always reinvents himself when he needs to, you know what I mean? So I think that he would reinvent himself, but if a classic John Williams score just wouldn't work. No, it doesn't work. And like, I did a movie called Exist, which was like a Bigfoot movie. And I remember the editor, put in like a bunch of like really kind of not only John Williams but like big movie, and I was like, no dude, you're completely overpowering the images, like the music is so big. So all my movies, like up to at this point, have always had like a weird kind of you know, like the end of Blair Witch, the music at the end of during the credit, like just very like not really a lot of melody, like very kind of almost noisy, you know. And, you know, I had the group Tortoise do the soundtrack to Lovely Molly, which was awesome. But it's always this kind of off, you know, like I love, especially for horror movies, I love kind of, you know, making people uncomfortable. And John Williams, even though he does it in his own way, for me, it's like there's a different kind of discomfort that I want. Like I want kind of like almost like a sonic discomfort sometimes. And and John Williams is not that kind of, you know, composer, but I'm dying to do a movie, like a bigger movie or an action movie that has like a, you know, like a regular score, because I've never done it before. I would just love to be able to sit in and, you know, watch, you know, one of my movies be scored. I think, you know, that would be a crazy, crazy
experience, you know. Because I mean, obviously it, you know, sets the tone for scenes, sets tones for movies. And, you know, I think people forget, like, A New Hope did not have the Imperial March, the Darth Vader theme. Like, it didn't have that. That didn't come out till Empire Strikes Back. Yeah. And it just, but like, even in that, like, it's just so, like, it's just like,
but,
okay.
But again, yeah, like, and that's the magic of Star Wars, I think. Like, you know, I mean, obviously it was a crazy, you know, phenomenon in its own right. But like, if Empire Strikes Back had sucked, like, like a lot of sequels, you know, there wasn't many sequels back in those days, you know?
Right.
If Empire Strikes Back sucked, that would have definitely tarnished. But the fact that Empire Strikes Back was better.
Yeah.
And, you know, Return of the Jedi, you know, you could argue, you know, both ways, whatever. But Empire was like, you know, 3 years later, and it was like, you know, and again, listening to the Imperial March for the first time was like,
yeah,
you know, like something. It was almost like John Williams is a lot like the Beatles, I think. Like the Beatles, I think, somehow magically tapped into like these melodies of old, like from our ancestry or something. Like there's something familiar about like Yesterday or like,
yeah,
you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. There's something familiar about those melodies for some reason, you know,
like they have a secret code, right?
Yeah, like I have a secret code. And I think John Williams is the same way. Like somehow he tapped into this Imperial March, and even though you've never heard it before, you're like, dance, you're like, yeah, you know it. You're like, oh, this is a hit, this is Darth Vader. And you know, so it was just like, you know, there's, and you know, and just all the theme, you know, the Yoda theme, and you know, the stuff with Leia and Han, and you know, just, you know, it's just any, and it's the only thing, like, you know, regardless of how you feel about, you know, the rest of the Star Wars movies, you know, John Williams is the only thing that's been like, it's been on point.
Yeah.
Every single time.
The most consistent thing. Most
consistent, like, quality wise, like, you know, if there was a good movie to be pulled out of that, those prequels or, you know, so, whatever. Yeah. John Williams was part of the reason that, you know, any of that stuff worked. You know,
this is what I want to know. I want to know your thoughts on all those other movies, those
the prequels,
the sequels,
and the new ones. I mean, you know, like I mean, I love Star Wars. Like, yeah. I love, as you can tell. I think, I don't know if you can tell by
just a little bit.
I love like the design of it. Like, I think it's like the most talented, not only like filmmakers, but production designers and, you know, visual artists, special effects. Like it's the top, and even toy makers, like it's the top of the, you know, that's the most advanced, the best people making these movies and, you know, coming up with the makeup and special effects and, you know, animatronic stuff, all that stuff. So for me, even though I don't like, you know, I dislike certain parts of the movies, and some of the movies infuriate me, I still love them. Like I just watched, you know, Attack of the Clones the other day, which I think is probably the worst movie in all of the nine, you know, movies in the Skywalker saga.
There.
But still, I mean, that battle at the end, it's still like those ships and just nobody does it like George. You know what I mean? Like he is a great world builder. So, you know, the prequels, I think, are... I love the fact that he was trying something new, because he really was like that. That had very little to do with the first three movies, you know, with the movies that came after. Like, it was like a completely new series. You know what I mean? Like the look of it, like the fact that, you know, he was able to go back to Coruscant, and it was
right.
It was,
how is this the same world that Luke Skywalker lived in? Right.
Exactly. And why do the X-Wing fighters look like they're, you know, 50 from 100 years ago, and they're actually in the future? Anyway, right. we can nitpick on that too. But
I'd love to.
To me, I love the fact that he was trying something new. And I think I didn't appreciate that as you know, until I saw the new movies, which I love the new movies. You know, I think the characters are cool. Obviously, I loved, you know, all the stuff about it. But I thought that, like, it was kind of lazy for them to... Force Awakens was like, why do a remake? You know, why steal so many of the beats from the original movies? Like, you know, in I understand, like, in certain, you know, reboots of franchises, you're like, okay, nobody under 15 or 18 has seen any of these movies, so we have to introduce it. We have to kind of introduce the original kind of, you know, the story or whatever. We got to catch people up. I mean, no, everybody's seen Star Wars, man. I mean, it's the best, you know, the most seen movie on video probably ever. Like that series. Yeah. Like you can't tell me that the kids coming to see Force Awakens had never seen, you know, the original trilogy. You know what I mean? Like 99% of the people that watched that movie had seen every single Star Wars thing before that.
Of course.
You know, so for me, it's like you could have started somewhere completely fresh and taken a whole new approach to it and still have the same characters. Like I love the characters. Like I love Rey and, you know, Finn and Poe. Like I think, you know, some of the best actors, you know, around, like just interesting to see, but they completely underutilized the original cast.
Han Solo is a deadbeat loser now.
Yeah, Han Solo is just a loser, and he's like him and Leia haven't figured it. And the problem, man, is that, you know, after Return of the Jedi, we get like these 3 or 4 minutes of like, the Empire is gone. Look, they're dancing, you know, the new versions. They're dancing on Coruscant, and they're dancing on, you know, Cloud City, and there's a, you know, like a galaxy-wide celebration as like the Emperor is dead. You know what I mean? Like, holy mm-hmm. shit. And then Force Awakens starts and the fucking Empire is back.
It's like, all for nothing.
Right. It's worse than ever. Yeah. Like, holy crap. Wait, we went through this trilogy and you didn't give us like a little bit of oh my God, there's a time of peace, but things are starting to unravel. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, because technically you didn't have to see the prequels to watch, you know, the sequels. Man, if you watched Jedi and then it goes into Force Awakens, you'd be like, wait, what? What the hell? Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's going
all
on?
All that sacrifice just was for
and
nothing.
And when I saw, like, you know, Poe put like that chip or whatever in BB-8, I was like, come on. So now the droid has the secret plans or secret whatever location of Luke's hideout or whatever. And I mean, you're really going to go like that close to me that it lost me at that point. And I still like the movie, you know, like I think J.J. Abrams is super talented. I've loved most of his stuff, you know, or at least, you know, even if I don't like some of his stuff, there's always good stuff in there. And again, this, you know, there's so much great stuff in Force Awakens, but I just felt like, I don't know who to blame, really. I mean, I think Disney has a lot of the blame, Lucasfilm, whatever. Kathleen Kennedy, like they always blame her. I have no idea, but just the idea of like treating the audience with like that much disrespect as far as like, oh, these people have seen nothing. So they have to start. We have to start from the very beginning. And it was just like, no, man, you don't have to. And that's why Mandalorian works so well, and why Mandalorian, everybody loves Mandalorian. Like there's very few people that don't like Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. It's because it didn't have the baggage of the Skywalker saga, and they just kind of wanted to do something new. So for me, it was like, I thought that, like, you know, it was just a missed opportunity of like not starting with Han Solo and Leia and like see a little bit of what's going on. Like, give me some happiness. Like, give me like, oh my God, they're going to see, you know, their grandchild is being born or something. And then you're like, oh shit, there's an attack. And oh shit, there's what the hell's the Empire in
the resistance.
I don't even know. The First Order.
Nobody even knows.
And also like the whole thing of like, you know, the TIE fighters were just a TIE fighter with a different color band and then a little, you know, laser on and the X.
We got to recognize it.
We're just redesigned. Like, come on, man.
I know.
It's 30 years later or whatever it is. Like, you know, the ship designs have changed. Like, come on, man. You know, like don't think that people are so stupid that they're not going to like the movie because you don't have X-Wings or a Death and the Death Star thing again. Like, again, you're going to do the Death Star?
I got to say, that's a fantastic point about Han and Leia and Luke, because, you know, you bring them back into the movie because clearly for the old fans, but you don't even give the old fans what they want, which is to see them together. So at that point, why even have them in the movie
and they're miserable, right? Like, you've caught, you know, and you know, Last Jedi, you know, Luke is basically an alcoholic, or you know, like you know, drinking the blue milk, and like he's crazy old man on an island. Like, really, that's not what I want to see, man. And also in Last Jedi, like when they show the X-Wing underwater, I was sure that I knew the end of the movie. Like, I was like, oh my God, some messed up thing's going to happen. And the end of this movie is going to be Luke raising that X-Wing fighter. And you're like, oh my God, Luke is going to, and the next movie starts with Luke completely kicking ass. And, you know, you can kill him there if you want, but let me see Luke really kick ass, not a holographic projection of him.
Yeah.
Let me see Luke really kick, you know, a battalion of stormtroopers' asses and like,
right.
Let me see what I've been paying. You know, I've been waiting for 40, 50 years almost to see Luke Skywalker kick ass. Let me see that. Even the, you know what I'm saying, like you know, George gave us Yoda kicking ass.
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Like,
well, the sequels don't bother me until I start thinking of what could have been, like what you're saying. Like, man, like when you say it, how like the end could have been him lifting the X-Wing up.
To me, like the end of you know, and I like Last Jedi. Like, I don't, you know, it was a good movie, and Rian Johnson's a really talented filmmaker. But like the end of Last Jedi, I'm like, they're basically, there's the rebellion. Nobody came to help Leia. Like, they're just, what the hell, what am I got to look forward to in the next movie? Like, they're just, you know, it's like, they've gone from bad to worse. And to me, it's like, you could have done that. You could have been like, oh my God, Leia and, you know, the last bits of the resistance are about to get slaughtered. And then, but have Luke come in, like really Luke, like have a real scene between real Luke and real Leia. Like, can you at least give me that?
Well, the best we can get is a CGI version in Mandalorian. That's the best we can get.
Yeah, exactly, man. And, you know, so to me, it was just like, you know, I don't know. It was a little lazy and a little like not, didn't satisfy the itch, you know.
My biggest issue, I think, with the sequels is just production wise, how they didn't have a plan to begin with for the trilogy. Like, they just kind of went, know, like, all right, you're a director, you can come in and do your thing. You're the next director, do what you want.
I don't understand that at all. And look, I mean, like, to me, I know that, like, Rise of Skywalker, I think a lot of people hate it, but I really loved Rise of Skywalker just because JJ got a complete shit sandwich. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
not that Last Jedi was a shit movie, but like, where do you go from Last Jedi? You've killed Luke, you've killed Leia, you're about to kill Leia. You're like, there's like, you know, like where the hell do you go from there? Han is gone. And, you know, there's like, to me, it was like,
and then he had the uncontrollable circumstance of, you know, Carrie Fisher passing. So like,
exactly.
He
couldn't even, the thing is, like, to me, like, what is he, you know, the shit that was part of the shit sandwich, the main part of the shit sandwich. Cause you know, the third one was supposed to be about Leia, you know what I mean?
Right.
And the idea that like, he actually came up with something that actually was kind of cool, and like the Leia thing is kind of satisfying. Like, you know, it's not the best thing in the world, but, and the fact that, you know, the end is, you know, like, you kind of end up liking Kylo Ren and Rey. I mean, the Emperor kind of, it makes sense that he's still the bad guy, you know what I mean, after all this time.
How much do you think the prequels would have been enhanced if an actor like Adam Driver, let's say Adam Driver was that age when the prequels came out, Adam Driver played Anakin.
That's a good question, man. Like, because
I asked.
Yeah, because Hayden Christensen, I mean, you know, the same thing with Natalie Portman. I mean, they're good actors. Like, you know, Natalie Portman's an Oscar winner.
Right.
Somehow George just sucked the life out of them, especially in Attack of the Clones. So I'm not sure if an Adam Driver would have helped, you know?
Yeah.
Look, I love George Lucas, and I, you know, part of the reason that I'm talking to you here and I did Blair Witch was because George Lucas got me into filmmaking, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that the prequels are, you know, even though they're not perfect movies, there are a lot of great ideas in there. There's so much great artistry in there. And, but I think that, you know, George hadn't directed anything in like 30 years or whatever.
Right.
Saying. And I think that, like, me personally, like I've gotten, ever since I started directing television, I've gotten I'm such a much better director now. Like, I'm just faster. I can find scenes. I can work with actors faster. I know what I want, you know, because you know, you're exercising that muscle. So I couldn't imagine having not worked on anything for, like, you know, whatever it was, 30 years. And then you're directing like a $250 million movie all of a sudden, and you're writing it. Like, yeah, this is madness. And obviously, you know, he could do it because it was his, you know, it was his property, his companies. And I respect that, you know, and to me, like, I'll support that decision. But if it was me, I would have directed a maybe a smaller film, a couple of smaller films. Like, I would have just gotten my feet wet a little bit and then said, okay, now I'm going to go and direct. Because there's a certain stiffness in the prequels, and by Revenge of the Sith, a little bit of that thing has worn. It's a little like Revenge of the Sith flows better because it's his third film. He's
working out the kinks.
He's working out the kinks, man. He's becoming a better director, you know. And I just think that's a great point. It was just a mistake, and I think he should have brought in like other writers from the start.
Well, I mean, that's what he did, you know, in the original trilogy. I mean, A New Hope he directed, the other two he didn't. So, I mean, we've asked this before, but was A New Hope a fluke for George Lucas?
No. Okay. No. Because, I mean, you know, American Graffiti is a fun, well-acted, you know, well-paced, like, it's one of my favorite movies from the 70s, you know? So I think, you know, he hasn't directed that many movies, but, you know, I think he's got the skills. It's just, you know, he wanted to make the prequels and he did them. And I respect that, you know, it's like, it was his stuff, you know? But again, you know, I think they would have ended, again, like you were saying, like the what if.
Right. Yeah.
Like exactly. Again, like somebody brought up the other day, like, what if, like, Lucas had actually been making, you know, like, maybe taking a break and started, like, a new trilogy, like, in the 90s when, you know, Harrison Ford was still relatively young and Carrie Fisher was still young and Luke and, you know, everybody was still, you know, in their prime, instead of waiting until, you know, they're all, you know, Carrie Fisher, like, literally died during production of the last, you know, couple movies.
And now let's make a fifth Indiana Jones.
Yeah, right? and again, like, you know, you look at Harrison Ford and some of those, like, questionable Harrison Ford roles, like, from the 90s, and you're like, God, they would have just made another freaking, you know, so just every 5 or 6 years, if they would have done an Indiana Jones movie, except waiting until he's, like, in his freaking 80s. And he still looks great.
It does, actually,
you know, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, even though everybody hates it, like, for me as an Indiana Jones movie, it still worked. You know, like, even him as an older dude, I'm like, you know, it still works. You know what I'm saying? Not, it doesn't work as well as Raiders or, you know, Temple of Doom, but it still works. So, again, it was just kind of lost opportunities. But, you know, what are you going to do?
I have to ask, well, first of all, real quick, is I find the prequels more rewatchable than the sequels. I do not go back to the sequel movies. I just don't. But I wouldn't mind just throwing on Phantom Menace, something like that. Leave that aside. But I want to know your thoughts, Ed, on Rogue One.
I loved it. I think it's, like, definitely the best, you know, post, you know, original trilogy and prequel trilogy. I definitely think it's better than any of the sequels. Mm-hmm. And again, I think the reason it's better is that it doesn't have as much baggage as the Skywalker saga movies. You know what I mean?
Right.
And the same thing with what's one of the reasons I think why Solo didn't work. I mean, first of all, they released it too soon after Last Jedi, when Last Jedi had not really energized the base much. You know what I mean? So they released it like 6 months after Last Jedi, and, you know, they're surprised that it didn't do any money, any business. But to me, the main flaw in Solo was that you're asking us to, like, replace Harrison Ford, who's, like, one of the most beloved actors of any era, especially of our era of, you know, I grew up, I mean, he's my favorite actor for sure of, you know, amazing. As far as, like, you know, Blade Runner. And I mean, even his flops, I like, you know what I mean? Like, he's an interesting actor who's, like, made the best of the talents he has, you know what I mean? And, but I think that, wait, what were we talking about? I completely lost my train of thought.
Solo,
you were talking
about Solo.
But you're asking me to, like, believe that this guy who was really, you know, who was a good actor is Harrison Ford. And it's, it, that's just too much baggage. You're asking me to you know, to, it's just too much. You know,
yeah, and I tried to put that aside and just, all right, it's yes. the character Han Solo, but it's yeah. just like it doesn't
and then,
work.
And then another thing with Solo, like, why is this such a dark movie? Like,
yeah,
I mean, Solo should have been like, I mean, I understand that Rogue One was a dark, you know, it's a very adult movie. It's the most adult Star Wars movie. I mean, like, everybody dies at the end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like the most, you know, there's no sequel to Rogue One, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, like, you know, Solo should have been more like, all right, let's bring a little bit of the original color palette back and like not light it like it's freaking, you know, like a freaking horror movie. Like yeah. the first half hour of Solo, you're like, you can barely see what's going on.
Yeah, there's that weird right. car chase in the beginning.
There's no reason for it, you know. And then the problem with Solo also was that I'm a big fan of like the original of the one of the book trilogies, like the Rebel Dawn trilogy. I don't know if you guys ever read. You know, you're probably not as Star Wars geeky as I am, but there's this trilogy. There's this trilogy of Han Solo books, and if you read any Star Wars books, and you're a Star Wars fan, you know, want to read any of the books, I think these are the books that you want to read. There's three books, and it's not the original Han Solo sequels that came out in the 80s books, but the ones that I guess they came out in the 90s or early 2000s. But there are three books, and it literally starts with Han Solo, like, as a kid, an orphan on Corellia,
yeah.
like being basically pressed, you know, by a pirate gang. Like, they just grab him off the streets and they put him on a ship, and then you're like, okay, now you're part of the crew, kid.
Oh, man.
And the fact that, like, he, you know, there's a Wookiee there, like a Wookiee woman that befriended him, and, you know, and that's how he learned Wookiee, and that's how he learned to love, you know, Wookiees. And so basically he was raised by a woman, you know, a female Wookiee, which I thought was, you know, I just love that, you know what I mean? Yeah.
So he
meets Boba Fett, he meets Lando, and at the end of the third book, he literally, like, you know, Luke and Ben are coming to sit down with him.
Oh, that's great.
And Tina, and it ends
that's
there.
That's great. Oh.
And it's a great story. Like, I was like, oh my God, if they can make this in the movies, it would be great, because at that point you start as a little kid and you're able to, like, accept, okay, we've never seen her, you know, Harrison Ford as a kid. You know, it gives you a little more chance to accept him as Han Solo. Mm-hmm. And then when you switch up to, like, the, you know, the older, you know, actor, then it, you know, I don't know. I think it would have helped, you know what I'm saying, if you would have kind of given me. But it was just like this, it just wasn't.
It
wasn't what I wanted, man. You know,
so those books didn't do the wonderful choice of having the Empire give him his last name?
No, and it's like, who cares?
Like, right,
did you ever wonder where Han Solo got his last name? No.
Right, yeah.
Never. Like,
it would have been way better if he just said, I'm alone, Solo. Like, yeah, and he just gave his own last name.
Exactly.
But
it was just, like they were kind of filling in, you know, holes that didn't need to be filled in, you know.
I do appreciate that, you know, speaking of the books real quick, Dave, sorry Dave to cut you off, but I appreciate the new canon they made when Disney bought it. I do like that they try to, you know, keep it all together, and I've been into all the canon books and all that, and speaking of Rogue One, Catalyst was an amazing book, I thought, to read.
Absolutely, man. Like, yeah, I mean, I think that they did the, you know, like, I've read I mean, there's so many books. I probably read about half of them at this point.
Yeah.
I was trying to go through all of them, but I got to the point where I just couldn't read any more Star Wars books.
it's a lot.
If you guys get a chance, read those first, Solo trilogy. It's just really fun. And they're also, like, you know, you notice, I'm sure you guys notice that they're pulling things from the, like, unofficial books.
Yeah.
They're, you know, Thrawn came from there, and they're pulling a lot of, like, cool ideas. So I thought,
yeah, I love that.
Going
yeah.
into Solo, I was like, oh, they're going to pull some of the best stuff from the books, but they didn't pull anything, man. I was really disappointed.
I want to get back to Rogue One real quick, but I have to ask you, Ed, is Darth Maul dead or alive? Should he be dead or alive?
You mean, like, as far as, like in the Mandalorian?
Did he die in Phantom Menace, according to your brain?
He died in... Okay, look. Yeah. I mean, look. You know, you got to kind of suspend your little, you know, a little bit of disbelief. But if they had brought Darth Maul back and it had been like this kind of like almost like they had brought back, like they brought, like they did in the sequels with the original characters, like bring Han Solo in, give him very basically and nothing to do, and then kill him at the end. I would have been like, nah, that's a waste of Darth Maul. But they did some cool stuff, man. Like, I mean, did you guys watch Clone Wars?
Yeah.
You know, like I love that he was kind of losing his mind.
Yeah, and, I like
that too. Like, I thought that was like, you know, that was cool. It was like this really darkness. Now, you know, the fact that they're continuing to keep him, you know, I think it was like one of those, I think they realized what a cool character he was. And then they're like, oh my God, we killed him. We got to bring him back somehow. But, you know, it's Star Wars. So,
yeah, exactly.
Always going to be, you know, things like that. We were like, all right, I guess like Boba Fett should have died in the Sarlacc pit.
That's true. Well, I mean, still,
they say nobody escapes the Sarlacc pit.
Well, and, go ahead, Dave.
What about Rogue One? I did, because that's how we started this. I still wanted to get your thoughts on this, so we veered off into Solo. I think it's either the second or third best Star Wars movie made. And it made me love a droid in K2SO as much as I love R2-D2. I thought the characters were perfect. Everything was pitch perfect in that film, and I cannot believe that they didn't, maybe obviously everybody died at the end of the movie, but that wasn't the template going forward for all future Star Wars films. I was every time I watch that movie, I am blown away by how good it is.
It's good, and again, I think part of it is the fact that it's like, you know, it's part of the Skywalker saga, but it's just like a little cousin of the Skywalker saga. And I just think that, like, you know, the problem that JJ and, you know, Rian Johnson and even George Lucas had when he, you know, when after the original trilogy, is that that original trilogy means so much to so many people. You know what I mean?
Right.
So there was no winning. You know what I mean? Like, if they had done like what I wanted to do, somebody else would have been mad. And I would have probably been mad at something, you know, oh, you know, you should have done something different. You know what I mean? Like, you can't win. That's why, like, people ask me sometimes, like, you know, would you ever want to direct the Star Wars movie? I'm like, not a major Star Wars movie. No. Like, if they get to a point where they're doing like kind of offshoots, like little, you know, $10 or $20 million, like little side Star Wars movies, like direct to, you know, Disney Plus or whatever. And again, like the TV shows to me is like perfect, like a perfect thing. Mm-hmm. But as part of like the official canon of Star Wars, like, that's a lot of pressure, man. And I don't know. And also, like, I think that you know, with a movie that big, like, I'm not sure how much, like, even JJ didn't have autonomy. You know what I mean? And if they didn't give JJ autonomy, they're certainly not going to give me, you know, final cut, or, you know, let me make all the, you know, major decisions. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
I think that there's a certain amount of, like, sure, it would be cool to direct a Star Wars movie, but in the end, like, if you logically go down the road, I would get eaten up, and it wouldn't be a great experience, you know. So but a TV show, sure. I mean, I could direct a Star Wars TV show tomorrow, you know. I'm completely confident in my abilities, you know.
Well, we got to make a hashtag or something.
We got to get some kind of change.org or whatever. Some kind of petition going or something. No, I mean, I have a lot of connections, you know, at Lucasfilm. And again, I know Robert Rodriguez. So hopefully it's just a matter of time. All right, let's just bring this guy in and see what he can do, you know. So
I got to ask, if you could develop any Star Wars show, if you were given the reins to say, all right, Ed, go make a Star Wars show, what would it be?
I would, like, you know, I would kind of follow the Mandalorian model, which is like, find like a little corner of the world and then go crazy there. You know, like, I've always thought like a Star Wars horror movie would be cool. Like, like a group of rebels and like a group of squad of Imperials are like stuck on a planet. And there's like, you know, I mean, you could do any kind of creature you want in the
Star Wars. Oh my God.
But they have to kind of come together to help each other, and, you know, or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Something far away from the center of the Star Wars world. And
what would this be rated?
Dude, I mean, obviously, I would love to do a rated R, you know, Star Wars horror movie with, like, you know, crazy gore and stuff.
Oh, like the ghost of a Sith.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, supernatural stuff, man. Like, really kind of, you know.
Do a Predator style, even.
Maybe? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you know, I think the idea of, like, you know, the adventure of like a planet that's like inhospitable and there's weird shit. And then also there's like monsters and there's, they're fighting each other, whatever it is. I think, you know, it would lay, you know, it's come cool stuff. And also like the idea that like, I would love to take like a squad of stormtroopers and make them the good guys. Mm-hmm. Like,
ooh, yeah,
like they're like the rebels are the rebels there or whatever are just fucking assholes. And, you know, they, I don't know, whatever it is, you know what I'm saying? Something yes. where like they've been so far and it's just like, kind of like Saving Private Ryan, man. It's just these guys trying to survive, you know, yes. this, you know, and it's just normal guys and you get to know,
yeah.
you know, you get to like, you know, so, you know, it's something like that I think would be cool, but.
That's intrigued. That's what's intrigued me about some of the new canon books is, yeah, just having, you know, the seeing the side of the Empire where it's like these are just regular people who just they wanted to join the academy like Luke even yeah. wanted to do in A New Hope,
yeah.
you know,
and they, it's ended, just, up, yeah, and they ended up yeah. In the Empire, you know,
exactly. And I do apologize. We're at an hour and 20. I didn't mean to do this. I usually stick around an hour. I do apologize. So
no problem, man. I mean, we're talking a subject that kind of, you know, that I could talk about all day. So
it's sacred, you know, it's sacred.
It is.
Yeah. It's and then real quick, what so how much do you think did Rogue One enhance A New Hope for you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's like seamless yeah. From the end of Rogue One to
the
beginning.
No, I mean, that's the whole thing, man, is that like when, you know, when they do things right, they do things really right, you know, like,
yeah.
And, but, you know, but they don't do things right, you know, all the time, unfortunately. But, and, you know, and look again, like, and, you know, I'm not sure what happened with the production of Rogue One. I think it was just as tumultuous as any of the other movies. But for some reason, just the idea that, like, I think fans like us just gave it more wiggle room because it was, like, first of all, a serious movie. There was no, like, you know, silliness in that movie. Like, it was...
Right.
It was hardcore, man.
Yeah.
And also the idea that, like, you know, it wasn't, you know, you didn't have Leia or Luke or Han Solo or, I mean, nobody from the original trilogy was in it. You know what I mean? So I think that helped. It's the same thing with, you know, with Mandalorian. Like, to me, like, even the stuff with Boba Fett, like, I think that's unnecessary. Like, I think they cater too much to the original stuff. Like,
right.
And yeah. sometimes I'm like, they didn't need to make that, like, that connection. Like, that's my whole thing is, like, I think that they underestimate the idea that, like that the Star Wars universe is so diverse that they feel like we got to say, do something about from A New Hope, we got to give an Easter egg. And it's like, no, you don't. You don't have to put, you know, I mean, just the world itself, like, you know, will give you plenty of opportunities for to see like things that happened before and the timeline or are going to happen afterwards. But you don't have to like be so clever and you know, it just becomes like they're trying to cater to the fans too much, you know. And it's like, no, the fans want to see new stuff. They don't want to go back and rehash, you know, what happened in New Hope. You know, they just want to see something fresh, you know what I'm saying?
100%. Yeah, exactly. 100%.
What do they call it? Fan service? Yeah, it doesn't all need to be fan service.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's cool. I mean, I love the Easter eggs. I love seeing Boba Fett. You know, I love that. But again, it's like...
But it's like, make it more subtle, you know?
Yeah, like just like such a... Like, you know, like the whole coincidence thing of like C-3PO being built by Darth Vader.
Right,
ending up with Anakin, you know, it's like... Did it have to be that? Did C-3PO really have to be built by Anakin? Like, does that make it more special? Like, it just makes it kind of more convoluted. Yeah. So I think that, you know, they do that in Mandalorian sometimes a little bit too much. Like, okay, we didn't need to go there and do that.
Right.
And, you know, see that. But, you know, it's cool, obviously.
Yeah. I'll take it.
You know, you know, and the thing about them is that, you know, there's enough new stuff that, you know, it kind of, you know, when they do show stuff, it's like at least they're showing us, they're giving us some new storylines and some new characters and new
looks. Yeah, exactly.
New ships.
Even not the original, like they're, you know, going off of, you know, bringing in Ahsoka and all that. Like,
yeah.
You know,
like, and to me, like, I like that stuff, you know what I mean? But
yeah,
I
think
that,
definitely.
You know, like I like this, and that's what I liked about Rogue One is that it's completely separate. I mean, it is a prequel to A New Hope, but it's basically a completely separate film. You know,
yeah, they were able to prove that you can make something good within the universe, because that's what a lot of people say. Well, it's all just about Luke. Well, not really, because this story showed that it is, there is substance within the universe to tell different kinds of stories.
Yeah,
it was proven in that way. So
yeah.
Go make more, please.
Yeah, and I also love, like, the Mandalorian again. You know, like the idea of like life after the Emperor died. You know, like after the second Death Star was destroyed, like that's never, you know, that at least in, especially in film or and television for sure, other than the books, that era has never been seen.
Right.
And I think that that's, I mean, like for me, like, again, like we were talking back to Force Awakens, like I want to see what happened after Return of the Jedi. You know, like I've gotten a taste in the books, you know, the Empire's still around and, you know, there's this still the struggle, but there's like, I love the books where like Leia and Han got married and they had kids. Like there was like this, oh my God, there's they have lives. Even like Luke got married. Like I like that stuff. Like I
right.
That's a little better than being a hermit on an island, right?
Yes.
Yeah. A little
just
bit.
Just a tiny bit.
Yeah. Exactly.
Ed, it's been an absolute pleasure talking Star Wars with you. It's again, sorry to keep you so long.
No problem. I love it.
You're a blast to talk with about this. You're welcome back anytime.
Well, hold on. In A New Hope, they blow up the Death Star.
Oh yeah, and in A New Hope, yeah. Oh yeah, we were supposed to just talk. We were supposed to break down A New Hope in this episode, but we broke down Star Wars.
Star Wars in general, man.
Exactly.
It was so much more than the breakdown of one movie, you know? Because you can't. That's the whole thing. You can't really talk about A New Hope without.
Yeah, exactly.
It has its tentacles in everything. You know what I mean? So
definitely.
No, man. It's been a blast. Love talking to you guys, and invite me back whenever.
Yeah, absolutely. And when does your episode of American Horror Stories come out? Do you know?
It actually aired
aired.
Actually, I mean, it was crazy because I finished it and like 3 or 4 weeks later it aired. Like it was the quickest any episode I've ever done has aired. I think they're done with the season already.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they're like wrapped on the season. And then it was only like, I think, 8 episodes, I think. We're working on a feature right now that my partner's writing. We're working on TV stuff and I'm just waiting to see where I have a job in January in Vancouver, but my fall right now is open, but there's like a lot of slots that are kind of, a lot of people are kind of reaching out. So
excellent.
Right now I'm just waiting and also just waiting for the feature and, you know, hoping that we get, you know, some traction on our TV show. So,
well,
and collecting Star Wars crap.
Yeah, that takes a big part of your time.
It's a time waster, man. That's
yeah. Well, we cannot wait to see your episode of a Star Wars show. So we're looking forward to that.
Man. You know, for sure, after I do it, I'll come back and talk about it. Geek out. We can geek out together.
Sounds
can't
great.
Wait.
All right, guys.
All right, man. It's been a blast.
Thank you a lot, man. Appreciate it.
Yep, have a good one.
Take care.
There you have it, folks. We nerded out, like I said, on Star Wars. Everything Star Wars, the good, the bad. It's Star Wars. You know, we love it no matter what we think of the prequels, what we think of some of the sequels, it's Star Wars and we love it. We love being immersed in that world. And it was so fun talking with Ed about it. Eduardo Sanchez is his stage name, I guess you could say. But no, Ed, thank you so much for coming on. You folks can follow us on Instagram at Blockbuster Mentality and Twitter at Blockbuster Cast. That's where you get all the updates on the show and when they'll come out and everything like that. If you go to our website, blockbustermentality.com, that also lists the latest episodes. So just, and past episodes, we try to be a timeless show where you can go back and listen to past episodes. It's not, all movie news or anything.
thing. You can go back and listen to what we thought about Shawshank Redemption or Raging Bull, or, you know, these are all just timeless episodes. So go back and take a look at our past episodes. So, but again, so much fun on this episode, and I hope you all enjoyed it. But all right, folks. Well, that is it for me, for Dave and Ed. I'm Ben, and as always, grab some popcorn, grab some snacks. We'll catch you guys at the movies.